It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "The measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." By that standard, Salahuddin more than measures up. The former freedom fighter, Pittsburgh City Council member, and CEO of the Coro Center for Civic Leadership has achieved legendary status as a political activist and public servant. But like many of us, Mr. Uddin has a cloud hanging over him that, in his case, can only be eliminated by a presidential pardon. Early in his life, he had run-ins with the police, including a federal gun charge that remains on his record. Now he is seeking a pardon from President Obama in order to put that part of his past behind him. He joins us now in studio. Salahuddin, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
If you have a comment or question for Salahuddin, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Again, the number, 412-246-2002. Salahuddin, between 1965 and 1970, you found yourself caught up in the criminal justice system. I'll let you explain what happened.
Well, we were driving through the South, as we did frequently. We had left Mississippi and was traveling north back toward Pennsylvania with a group of guys in my car with me. It was late at night. Traveling, we crossed the Tennessee line into Kentucky, and soon after we got in Kentucky, we were pulled over by a state trooper. The car was searched. There was a gun, a rifle in the trunk of the car, and it was my car. It was my gun. He knew that I had brought it from Mississippi across state lines, and I was charged. There was no charge in possession of the gun. The charge was the transportation of the gun across state lines, and that's how I got charged. Eventually, I was sentenced to a 5-year federal prison sentence. I served 7 months and then was released on parole.
So this remains on your record. What is important for people to understand, and really what this goes back to, is your history, your years as a freedom fighter in the South, which during the 60s, certainly before the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, but even after that, it was a dangerous endeavor. It was dangerous to be traveling down there and engaging in the work you were doing, registering voters. And the people who were in power in the Old South weren't really ready or willing at that time to relinquish it, even though the laws had changed. So talk about what it was like for you, and allow those of us, particularly those of us who are white, to walk in your shoes and imagine the type of fear that you might be feeling.
You described it as a dangerous place and a dangerous time, and that is correct. Even though the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act had recently passed, that had almost zero effect on people's attitudes and behavior relative to civil rights and voting rights. So as far as many in the South were concerned, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act did not exist. And they continued to prevent people from voting. They continued to enforce racial segregation in schools, in public places, and they continued to harass agitators, as they called us, who were there to organize people to desegregate public facilities and to register to vote and participate in the democracy. So they, it was a very dangerous time. We had rules for how civil rights workers were to survive. You never allowed your automobile to get a flat if you can help it, and you're stranded out on the highway. You never run out of gas. If you could help it, you don't ride in racially integrated company in automobiles. You certainly don't ride in integrated company with a female. If a white woman was going to be in your automobile, she had better be in the back seat with you in the front seat, like driving Miss Daisy. But they had a very low toleration for that kind of intergender and interracial mixing in cars. It was almost certain that you would have a problem if any police officer saw a white woman in a car with a black man. So those rules were put in place to help civil rights workers in the South survive during those days. And of course, many didn't survive. We had lost many friends and colleagues who were beaten and jailed and some killed. And it was a very dangerous time.
And what would have happened if the authorities, if the police, many of whom were also at that time Klan members, caught you in one of the situations that you just described?
It is very likely that you would come to great bodily harm if you were caught out on a lonely road at night with a flat tire or out of gas, especially if you were alone. If they could associate you with being a Northern Yankee agitator as opposed to a local person, you were almost certain to end up pretty well beaten, jailed, and perhaps even worse.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest Salah Uddin. And let's take a call now from Robert in Pittsburgh, who has been waiting to jump in. Robert, welcome. You're on with Salah Uddin.
Thank you very much. First and foremost, I want to say that, sir, I support you in your quest for an executive pardon. And I'm saying this just not as somebody off the street, but as someone who last year had a series of unfortunate incidents that led to a misdemeanor. I'm now lobbying for a change in West Virginia's expungement statute. As you may well know, earlier this month, President Obama commuted the sentences of more than 40 people, and in doing so said that America is a nation of second chances, and it's certainly my deepest hope, sir, that you will get that second chance.
Thank you.
That the president so eloquently talked about.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, you mentioned the clemencies that the president has granted. My hope is that the president will extend that same grace to pardons and not just clemencies. If I could just take a moment to clarify the distinction.
Yes, and we may be, I myself might even be guilty of confusing the terms here. So yes, by all means.
Sure. If you are in jail, in prison, and you get a clemency, it will get you your sentence set aside and you'll be released from prison. That's one thing. If you already served your time and you're trying to get your record expunged, as you called it, then that requires a pardon. And that's a different kind of action for those who have already served their time and are now just trying to clean up their record. And so there have been any number of clemencies that the president has granted, but far fewer pardons. And we're hoping that, many of the president's actions depend on recommendations coming from the Department of Justice to the White House, to the president's desk for his consideration. And I'm afraid that many of the recommendations that have come forward have been for clemencies and not as many for pardons.
And obviously what you're seeking is, in fact, a presidential pardon. I want to go back to 1963, as you were a young man, and you had already been in trouble with the law. I would describe it as youthful indiscretions. And you're, like many of us, you're searching for what is my purpose in life. And I'm curious, what led you to become a freedom fighter? Because you made this decision to commit yourself to this, it sounds like, pretty early in your life, at the age of 22 or so.
I could tell you exactly when it happened. It happened on August 28th, 1963. I was with a group of young people who had traveled to Washington, D.C. for the March on Washington. And we stood in that on that lawn all day in the hot, sweltering August sun, waiting for the man who we had heard so much about to speak. And we listened to many of the speakers who came out before Dr. King. And then finally, frankly, I was looking for a huge man because the image that I had of him was that he was just a big hulking man because his actions were big and hulking.
You didn't know what he looked like.
I didn't know his height. He was a small man. This small guy walked out on the stage with a smile and a mild manner, and we listened to a speech. None of us knew at the time that it would be a classic speech that would be repeated 50 years later. But that speech is what made me say, I want to join his army. I want to be with him and the movement that he described. Because he talked about the events that happened in the South and the courage of the people in the South and the conditions that many people lived under and the need for people to stand up against that kind of wrongdoing. And I just decided at that moment, I want to be with this guy. And months later, I found myself on a bus on my way to Mississippi. My original intention was to take 4 months off of the summer and then go back to college. I never got back. 4 months turned into 4 years. And I worked in the Mississippi Delta primarily integrating segregated facilities and building the political infrastructure for, in the county where I worked, in Holmes County, 70% of Holmes County was African American. But there had never been an African American elected official. There had only been a handful of people who even had the gumption and the backing to walk into the clerk of court's office and say, I want to register to vote. That is a tremendous act of courage during this time and in this place in the Mississippi Delta. So there were only a handful of people who were willing to do it. The family that I lived with, the Montgomery family, their own children were the ones who they took to the segregated school and said, I want to enroll my children in this school. That is a bold, bold act. And that's the kind of activity that we were involved in. But it was the March on Washington and Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech that made me decide this is what I want to do.
What enabled you to persevere in the face of potential danger? There were freedom fighters, black and white, who were attacked, who were beaten, who were murdered. And I'm sure you knew well that that is a fate that you could have met with, even if you had been careful as you could be. So I'm curious, what kept you going with all this danger around you?
Interestingly, sometimes it was negative acts. Sometimes if one of our friends were arrested or beaten or killed, that makes you renew your commitment. And if things like that happen to you, it first scares you, then it angers you, and then you recommit yourself to the purpose that you're there for in a stronger way than before the incident happened. And when you watch, one of the things that impressed me most throughout my time in the South was the courage of the people in the South, the sharecroppers, the farmers who had been there for generations, who stood so much to lose, but yet they stood up. They took their own children to integrate these places. They usually lost their jobs. Oftentimes they would be thrown in jail. When I saw the, and all the time I'm thinking, I live in Pennsylvania. I can leave anytime I want to. But these people live here in Mississippi with the Ku Klux Klan. And that's a courage that I had just never experienced in my young years. And that impressed me more than anything.
So let's fast forward now to 1970. And, you know, here you are. You've been pulled over by the cops in Louisville, Kentucky. And they find this gun. Describe what the dialogue was like, if there was one. Did you have an opportunity to say, look, I'm carrying this gun to protect myself, and you guys should know exactly why I would need it?
No. There was no explanation requested or available. The charges were made. I finally made bond and eventually was able to get the case transferred out of Kentucky into Pennsylvania. But there's no discussion or dialogue that occurs if they find you and associate you with the civil rights movement. You're going to pay the price.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Salah Uddin, who is seeking a presidential pardon for a federal conviction 45 years ago. You applied for this back in 2012. How does it work? How do you go about doing this?
There's an application that's online in the on the website of the Department of Justice. It's a very thorough application. And you are required to, first of all, discuss what happened and how you got in the situation. What have you been doing since you were released on parole? Who are people who can be talked to see whether or not you have lived an honorable life since your release? And so they do follow up. They interviewed, the FBI interviewed everyone who I submitted as a referral. And then they finished their investigation, and you just have to wait. And I've been waiting for 3 years.
What do you think your chances are?
I don't know. Pardons are not high on the president's list so far as are clemencies, but I think the president is taking a look at pardons in a way that he has not before. And I think, quite frankly, I don't want to sound self-serving, but I think anyone would be hard-pressed to find a case that is more deserving than what I've had the opportunity to do since my release from prison.
Why didn't you apply sooner? I'm guessing that you could have applied in 2009 when Obama took office, or even sooner than that.
I don't know. It's a very kind of personal decision to make, to undergo the scrutiny and the publicity that comes with it. And so you just have to wait until you're ready to do it, and until you think that there's a chance that it'll get through.
Is a black president more likely to understand and identify with your case?
Well, I think a black president is, this particular black president, not any black president, but this particular black president, I think, is able to understand and identify. He said that Trayvon Martin could have been his son. And so, but the question of identifying and his ability to take action is a different thing. He has to weigh these things very, very carefully because there are so many repercussions for every single decision that he makes. So it has to be weighed very carefully.
What would you tell the president if you could make the case to him in person?
Primarily, I would not focus on the incident of what happened. That was 45 years ago. I would focus on what has happened since then. What have I done with my life? What am I doing now? What am I likely to do in the future? That's what has to be looked at considering a pardon, and that's what I would describe.
And if he doesn't pardon you?
Fine. I'm okay. My life is not teetering on the verge of this pardon decision. I will continue to do the work that I'm doing in my community in the Hill District, which is currently what I devote every day of my life to, improving the neighborhood that I grew up in. I'll continue to serve. Service is what I've been doing since then, since 1970. And service, public service, is what I'll continue to do. So with or without the pardon, I'll continue to do what I have been doing and feel very good about my life.
And as we look to the future, and as you, I don't know if hand off or handing the baton is really the right thing, the right way to word it, but as you inspire those who will step in for you and carry on your work in the future, how is that process going here in Pittsburgh, particularly as it impacts the redevelopment of the Hill District?
Well, both of them come together, the redevelopment and the leadership succession in the community. I've had the very good fortune to have some young people who I've been working with who are stepping into the leadership role in a very, very satisfactory way. Jake Wheatley was a legislative assistant when I was on city council. And now he's state representative, been there, I think, 12 years and doing a very fine job. Daniel Lavelle followed Jake Wheatley in my office as legislative assistant. And now he's the city councilman for the Hill District and downtown and the north side and doing a very fine job. Marimba Malayans, her dad and I were best friends. And I worked for him when he became a city councilman. We were very close, and she was the baby of his four kids. And now she's providing leadership as the executive director of the Hill District CDC, and all of them are collaborating and working with a much larger group of Hill District leaders who are working with the Penguins and the Executive Manager Committee and the mayor and the county executive in a very complex plan for the redevelopment of the 28 acres across the street from the Console Arena, but also to use that development as a catalyst for the development of the entire Hill District. That's what our challenge is. They are providing leadership to it, and I couldn't be happier with the work they're doing.
Former freedom fighter, Pittsburgh City Council member, and CEO of the Coro Center for Civic Leadership, Salah Uddin, joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. Good luck to you, and thanks for spending time with us here.
Thank you
studio.
For having me. I enjoyed it.
Coming up, how a photo of Roberto Clemente ended up being displayed at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.